And welcome back to the show today. Well, we have been telling you news about and from Hong Kong for months and months now, obviously beginning with the extraordinary thousands and thousands, if not millions of people, day after day protesting in the streets of Hong Kong against the forced grip of the Beijing leadership. And also, of course, in recent days, we're telling you about the coronavirus and the mass authoritarian quarantine going on there coming from Wuhan and striking medical workers in Hong Kong because they're concerned about the porousness of the borders from mainland China. Well, joining us now is a man who has spent much of his adult life in China, studying and writing about the society, taking a historical perspective. Frank DeCutter is chair professor of humanities at the University of Hong Kong and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He is a Dutch historian who specializes in modern China. He has been the chair at the University of Hong Kong since 2006. But before that, he was professor of the modern history of China at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. And he has written several books, including the classic The Discourse of Race in Modern China, to his award-winning People's Trilogy documenting the lives of ordinary people under Mao. He currently lives in Hong Kong, and his latest book is called The Cult of Personality in the 20th Century, How to Be a Dictator. Mr. DeCutter, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Thank you so much for calling from Hong Kong.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, what time is it there?
Well, it's close to midnight.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's a bit of a, yes, bit of a time difference.
It certainly is. Okay, first thing I need to ask you, and you know this is coming, is you've got it. Listen, you're a reporter, you're a historian. What is it like right now in the streets of Hong Kong vis-a-vis this coronavirus? What's going on there?
Well, my wife likes it because there's a lot of shopping that can be done. Since all the department stores are empty. But I guess ultimately it's just very boring. You just have to stay home. But let's keep it in perspective. There are only about 12, 13, 14 cases, and all of them are in hospital. And this is a city of about 7 million people. So you just have to stay home.
But why do you have to stay home? In other words, we've got flu. We've got all kinds of things that go on in the winter here in the United States. We're not terribly alarmed about the coronavirus. Why is this so unsettling to China?
Well, because, of course, across the border, you know, Hong Kong has its own separate political system and legal system, most of all. But across the border, of course, is China. And there, we don't really know what is happening. And obviously, that is rather worrisome. In cities like Wuhan, you have hundreds of people who have died of this very serious virus. I'm not a medical doctor, but very few people die of ordinary flu. The coronavirus is something different altogether.
You know, that's so interesting, Frank, that you would say that, because actually, at least in the United States, thousands of people die from flu every year. Thousands, not hundreds, yeah, thousands.
I know. I've heard this argument. Again, I'm not a medical doctor, but ordinary people who are in good health do not die of the flu. They die because there are underlying causes or underlying issues.
Mm-hmm.
So the coronavirus, really. Like SARS in 2003, is a real killer. A very healthy young man will get very sick if they get it.
Yeah, you see that, and I really think that's so it's so different, the perception of information that we're getting, because, for example, I interviewed a woman who lost her six-year-old to flu last year, and she was not immune compromised in any way. She had had the flu vaccine. She was a very healthy six-year-old. It struck with the force of a tornado. She perished. She died in hospital, and it was a true tragedy. It is a true tragedy, but we hear about these kinds of flu deaths every single year. And I think that might be why, at least from the United States point of view, there just is not this kind of fear that is going on throughout our communities. We're taking precautions and all of that. But I don't think we have this fear. And I just was trying to get to what this was about in Hong Kong and in China. Is it because there is not really a trust that the Chinese government is telling you the truth altogether? Is that part of the fear?
Well, that's always an issue when you deal with one-party states, dictatorships. As you know, there is no there are no checks and balances, no opposition party, no transparency, no freedom of speech. So you just don't know what to think. It was the same story some 20, 25 years ago with AIDS. The People's Republic of China, the regime counted them in the tens of cases, and all of a sudden it jumped to thousands. With SARS, same story. SARS, another coronavirus that appeared in 2003, that was denied by the government for a very long period of time until it was too late. And we've had the same scenario right now. The very doctor who first pointed at the existence of this real, true killer virus quite a while ago was warned to not speak publicly about it.
Yeah, and so that just backfires. And so it just backfires on the government, really. Just backfires on them.
Well, the issue is we just don't know what to believe. It's very difficult to believe anything. It could be more worrisome. It could be less worrisome. On top of that, we don't know much about this virus.
So are you getting in Hong Kong, do you get your information censored significantly in terms of Google, or do you have a way?
No, thank God, no.
No. Okay.
Thank God, no. We do have very basic freedoms of information here. But, of course, it's a completely different world once you cross the border and you go into the People's Republic of China. It's a different planet. Your Google will not work. Your BBC News will not work. Even your South China Morning Post, which is published here in Hong Kong, will not be readable. If you watch TV in the evening, anything about Hong Kong will be blacked out when there are demonstrations, for instance. So it's just a different planet altogether.
So, Frank DeCutter, are the demonstrations continuing, or did they continue up until this recent coronavirus scare? Have they been continuing?
Well, they're not going to go away anytime soon. But, of course, right now we've entered a period of, a very uneasy truce, so to speak. But that's been going on for quite some time. Of course, you might very well say it started in 2014 with the Umbrella Movement when literally a million or two people came out to protest and blocked the center of Hong Kong. It's not going to go away. People are concerned about how these very basic freedoms we have are being gradually undermined, if not crushed, by the People's Republic of China.
And personally, as somebody, and you sound, I don't know what you look like, but you sound like you're of, Dutch descent, English descent, not Asian. What is your thinking about for the people who have been born and lived in Hong Kong their whole life and want freedom there? What do you think about the possibility of having that freedom?
Well, the point is, of course, it's very easy for me and others to talk about what is happening. But it's for very young people, the ones who demonstrate, for very young people. It is they who may very well have to face a future in which these basic freedoms no longer exist. And that's why they are the ones who fight, and very courageously so.
They certainly are. And I have to say their courage has been extraordinary to watch from where I sit. And I'm on the East Coast of the United States, where everybody has, a big mouth and a megaphone, and nobody's afraid to say what they're on their mind, generally speaking. Generally, I mean, there are limits. So, Frank, you've written this book, and the newest book that you've written is How to Be a Dictator, The Cult of Personality in the 20th Century. Now, we're in the 21st century. But would you say the same kind of reasoning applies to what's happening now? And what do you think about what is happening in Eastern Europe, for example, and in Russia, and of course China, where you sit, and even the United States and South America? Tell me about this cult of dictatorship that you see as a historian.
Well, you have to realize that it's obviously very pleasing to describe people you don't like as dictators, but if you don't have a good definition, it might not be all that helpful.
Okay.
So a dictator really is somebody who has a monopoly over power. Now, what is a monopoly over power? It means that there is no independent judicial system. There are no checks and balances. There's no rule of law. There's no opposition party to speak of. You know, that's a dictatorship. And under a dictatorship, of course, it's not just every street that is policed. It's also every mind. And the cult of personality really is a phenomenon that appears in the Soviet Union, but also later on with Mussolini, with Adolf Hitler, and of course elsewhere under dictatorships, where people just have to glorify their own dictator. You know, cheer his name, shout the slogans, parrot the party line, appear to be enthusiastic, and claim this man as a great genius, even if deep down they absolutely loathe him. So this is where you see these scenes, for instance, to this very day in North Korea of masses of people who seem to absolutely adore the man in charge. And the real scary aspect about that is that this cult of personality creates a climate in which everybody has to lie. Everybody has to pretend that they're absolutely loyal to their own leader. And in the end, nobody knows who believes what. So that cult of personality is really there to not so much convince people that their own leader is an absolute genius who can never, ever do wrong. No, the point is just to crush common sense, to destroy the individual and his dignity, to enforce obedience, to make people self-monitor and in turn self-censor and of course in turn monitor other people.
So when I think about that, I think of Hugo Chavez, I think of Kim Jong-un,
yes,
obviously, and obviously Hitler and
yes,
Mussolini.
Kim Jong-un.
And it never
right.
ends well, right? I mean, historically, when we look back at what you now define as dictatorships, it doesn't end well for the society at large. A society that may have had a prosperous class doesn't any longer, and not to mention the human cost of all the freedoms and the suffering. It doesn't end well. So let me ask you this. We're chatting with Frank DeCutter live from Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. What is in a society that you believe, how does a society get there? And once they're there, so let's talk about Kim Jong-un, because he's already been there a long time like his father.
Mm.
Is it
indeed?
Is it simply the fact that most people are cowardly? Human nature is what it is. We are a fear. We are a fear. We are an afraid species. And the risk versus benefit, you just sort of hide in your corner and lead a life of desperation rather than take on. In other words, I want to know why, Mr. DeCutter, and I really want to know this. Why doesn't North Korea, for example, have a robust underground opposition?
Well, because it's been rooted out, and not just the father, Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-il, but Kim Il-sung, of course, is the very
right,
first
the grandfather,
one.
Right.
And
right.
Exactly, the grandfather. So
yep.
he was installed by the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union went into Korea at the very end of the Second World War, 1945, and went right up to the 38th parallel to wait for the Allies, the United States. Well, they stayed in North Korea and installed Kim Il-sung. So without the Russians, he would have been nothing. And of course, not just the help of the Russians, but the backup of the Red Army. So the key point to bear in mind is that dictators very frequently come to power through violence. The 1917 revolution in Russia under Lenin was a very violent seizure of power. And it's similar in many other cases. Take, for instance, Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao, when the red flag goes up in 1949 over the Forbidden City in Beijing, it really is the result of several years of a very brutal civil war in which the communists really fight tooth and nail and do not hesitate to massacre local populations and starve cities to death in order to obtain the upper hand. So it's really a military conquest. It's not some sort of, you know, great victory because the people welcome the Communist Party or welcome a dictator. So frequently, a dictatorship starts through violence. And as we know, frequently, power obtained through violence must be maintained through more violence. So what follows is frequently in the Soviet Union 1917, in North Korea 45, of course, I mentioned China 49, there are many other examples. What happens is a very rapid destruction of what we would recognize as the very basic structures of a democratizing society. In other words, judicial independence is eradicated, trade unions are oppressed, opposition parties are forbidden, the press is muzzled. You can no longer, after a year or so, say or do anything without the approval of the one-party state.
So let me ask you this, Mr.
DeCutter, Germany.
Because I'm on radio time, and that means I have to rush, which I apologize for.
Of course.
The exception to the rule, as you're telling me all of this, seems to me to be the 1933 election of Adolf Hitler. And
no, I don't think so.
Okay, that's what I want to hear from you. Did Adolf Hitler come to power
indeed
in a violent way or a nonviolent way?
Well, he did never obtain an absolute majority, and he was installed through a series of very sordid political maneuvers. He was installed as Chancellor of Germany in January 1933 by the aging Marshal Paul Hindenburg. Then, of course, the parliament was burnt down, and Hitler used the opportunity to terrorize the population as hundreds of thousands of brown shirts, or thugs, in other words, went around literally beating up people who were opposed to the Nazi Party. That included mayors of rather important cities. And then in March 1933, there was an election in which he again fails to obtain an absolute majority. And then at that point in time, he manages to proclaim through some directives that all opposition will be suppressed and claims absolute power. And then within months, opposition parties are suppressed.
Go away. Yeah, they have the Nuremberg laws and everything else and Kristallnacht and the
absolutely
whole thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. 100,000 ordinary Germans linger in jail even before the end of 1933. Ordinary Germans.
So that's what I wanted to know because, you know, with the passing of time and the history, I'm glad that you're on the show to remind us of that because I thought that Hitler came to power in a relatively peaceful way. I didn't realize it was – I knew about the brown shirts, but I didn't realize that the way that he got to power was, in effect, seizing it by sort of anti-democratic means. So I'm glad that you clarified
It's very
that.
Important. Yes, it's very important because wherever I go, there seems to be nowadays a 1933 metaphor. I was in India a week ago, and people told me that India was like Germany in 1933. There is a historian, I will not name him, who's written a piece about how the United States is in 1933. It trivializes what happened in Nazi Germany. It trivializes what happened to literally millions of people whose lives were crushed by the Nazi regime and, of course, other dictatorships. So one has to be careful.
That's what I want to do. That's why words are important. Terms. Thank you. And thank you for joining us today, Mr. DeCutter. The book is How to Be a Dictator, The Cult of Personality in the 20th Century. You can get it on Amazon, which is the way everybody gets books nowadays. And have a good night's sleep. And we really appreciate you calling into the show from Hong Kong. This has been really a very illuminating conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Frank DeCutter on The Lisa Wexler Show. We'll be back.